Oh, hey there. I am Guy Branum, and welcome to Pop Rocket. I don't know if you've heard about it, but it's a weekly show picking over all the pop culture we love to love. I usually come to a studio, and in the studio with me to talk TV, film, music, and, you know, a lot of those things that are entertaining to us are my dear beloved friends. One of them, she's a digital strategist. I don't know if you know her, but her name is Winter Mitchell Rohrbaugh.
Yeah, I'm sure you've heard of me. Hi. Hi.
Hi. So short.
Hi, Winter.
I'm a Valley girl now.
Hi. Winter, how was your pop culture week?
It was, wow, it was an emotional roller coaster.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just so taxing being in Trump's America.
You've never been more accurate in that assessment.
And we've got pop culture scholar and dyke about town, Karen Toxin.
Hey, Guy. Hey, Winter. Hey, Rocketeers.
Karen, you're back at school now. How's the semester going?
Semester is deep. It's intense. It's deeply pleasurable to be teaching them episodes of Soap from 1978.
Yes! Oh, Jesus Christ.
Which is lovely. I was like, you think that you've, like, trans people on TV or discussions about transness never happened on primetime television until Transparent? Well, guess what? Here's Jodi Dallas.
I mean, seeing what he, like, Norman Lear, and that was it Susan Harris who created?
Susan Harris, created by Susan Harris, who created so many great shows like Golden Girls, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
But, like, these shows, like, got into shit. Like, Archie Bunker had a lesbian cousin, like, 2 decades before Will and Grace, but, like, We had those 80s in between just convincing us that only nuclear families exist.
It's so true. Anyway, yeah. So it's really fun. It's really rewarding, but it's also like a lot of work. Every lecture is like, as I said, an hour and a half TED Talk every other day. So there you go.
It's work.
It's work.
Coming up on this week's show, we have two big issues to deal with, you guys. First of all, we will be officially convening the Committee of the Whole for the Pop Rocket Seal of Approval to decide whether or not we are handing the Pop Rocket Seal of Approval. I've come up with a nickname for the Pop Rocket Seal of Approval. Are you guys ready for it?
Oh my gosh, I'm so ready.
Okay, what is the nickname?
Bracing.
The Turnerover.
wow.
In honor of Tina Turner, original recipient.
I absolutely love that. And now it's giving me a new idea for what the award looks like, which is simply a turnover.
Yes, it's like
a hand pie.
Well, look, I've been watching too much Chopped, and I love when they have a Pop-Tart and
deconstructed hand pie.
Well, they always have to call it like a breakfast hand pie or a breakfast turnover instead of just a Pop-Tart because they're chopped. And we're also going to be talking about the state of the Adam McKay. Yeah. We're going to look at what's going on with Adam McKay. He's very present in our award shows, and we just wanted to check in and see how we think this pop culture creator and figure is going at this point in his career. And later in the show, we will, of course, be sharing our latest gems. Mm-hmm. But first, let's find out. No. We are not finding out what arts and entertainment news or events have caught our attention this week. Before all of that, it is time to convene the Committee of the Whole for the Pop Rocket Seal of Approval. All right. I call this meeting of Pop Rocket Seal of Approval Committee to order. It is now time for the roll call. Winter Mitchell Rohrbaugh.
Present.
Margaret Wappler.
Not present.
Margaret Wappler.
So not here.
Margaret Wappler. Margaret's husband, David, had like an auto thing happen and she had to rush home.
His wheel popped off on the 210
freeway. He's completely safe.
We planned on having all of us here, but Margaret has other human beings who she has to care for.
Right.
So she is not here.
And we don't have an alternate, so we mark her not present.
Yes. I mean, I think it maybe technically I have to check the bylaws. Sarah Gertrude Shapiro may have like voting power at this point in time.
We'll have her text in.
Yes.
Karen Toxin.
Yes.
All right. We having a quorum. It is now time to consider old business. The old business is the question of Mr. Terry Crews of Brooklyn Nine-Nine. And deodorant commercials.
He was tabled at our last discussion of the PRSOA.
And I would have to say, over the intervening weeks, I think his stock has only risen.
Oh, yeah.
Because, like, Was he a football player?
Yes, he was an NFL player who started with the LA Rams.
Okay.
Who, you know, when they were still in LA and before they left and now they're back. But yes, he played for numerous teams, but he was drafted by the LA Rams in 1991, I think.
And I know him primarily as a comic actor. And I, like, there have been so many stabs at guys trying to make the transition from athletics to acting. And I feel like it has been most successful in comedy scenarios. And, you know, you see somebody like John Cena, where in good hands, it can kind of work. Mm-hmm. And when he makes a movie about a former Marine trying to save his Pacific Northwest hometown, it feels gross and weird. But, like, then there are those people like Schwarzenegger, like Terry Crews, like The Rock, who just fucking get it, you know? Winter, how do you feel about this nomination?
I suggested it. I think that there, if there was ever a time for a leader who kind of appealed to your he was sensitive but handsome but funny and can sort of make fun of himself and also be kind of, you know, evocative and like be revealing, I feel like he kind of covers all of that.
Uh-huh.
And there's not enough of those men. I think there are other men like that, like a Kumail. Mm-hmm. Or we can say that there's other sensitive men out there, Mark Ruffalo's, like those type of guys who are just like...
You're Kumails and Mark Ruffalo's.
We're Kumails and Mark Ruffalo's. You're just out there and you're being, you know, sensitive and attentive and advocating and also like turning out quality work. He turns out quality work. Like there hasn't been too many turns that he's taken in his, you know, look, he doesn't have like some 30-year career. He's been around for quite a long time and he's sort of bounced around and done different types of movies, but he's always been consistently funny and memorable.
Yeah.
And I think the turn with Me Too and Time's Up and him revealing, you know, how he felt like he was violated and then willing to risk it all.
Well, I mean,
risk it all, really.
What's been fascinating in the past couple of weeks is there has been this conversation with a couple of people. I think D.L. Hughley was one of them.
Yeah.
50 Cent.
Who were basically sort of questioning. So if you don't know, Terry Crews, like, primary Me Too situation was he was at a party, like a Hollywood party, and an agent, like, grabbed for his genitals. In what this guy imagined was some sort of hilarious joke kind of mm-hmm. way. And Terry Crews, like, you know, was it's sexual battery. Like, grabbing anybody else's genitals, like, without having consent is sexual battery. And he has talked about that experience and what it felt like. And D.L. Hughley and 50 Cent and these guys were coming at him saying that he should have hit the guy and basically yeah. asking him to participate in this old school, like, masculinity where people who are powerful enough do not get sexually violated. And it's really so great to have a guy whose identity is masculine enough, mm-hmm. whose sense of self is strong enough to be able to say, like, I'm not going to pretend that that's true.
Right.
And
right.
for all the men and boys who've experienced abuse and harassment, I think it's important to have a voice, someone, again, whose masculinity is never in question, simply by the kind of his size and stature and, like, his status as an athlete, a former athlete,
yeah.
you know, to have somebody to be able to stand up to the bullies who would shout down that kind of revelation is key, and it's super important. And the thing is, this isn't like just a new thing that he's just taken up since the Me Too movement has yeah. happened. He's spoken out against many forms of abuse precisely because of the abusive background that he was raised in, and he's been very candid about that in talking about his own biography and about the abuse his mother experienced and he experienced at the hands of an alcoholic father. And so, I mean, he led with that kind of transparency and vulnerability, but it was never there to just be sentimental and to capture people's hearts in any kind of, you know, really kind of cloying way. He just told his truth. He told his story. He was born and raised in, like, Flint, Michigan. You know, we know about Flint, Michigan.
Yeah.
I mean, Margaret is not here to act as the snob's advocate. So I suppose it is my job to step into that role. What I will say is, as the first person to place a name in consideration for the Pop Rocket Seal of Approval. Mm-hmm. It was the very similar career of one Dwayne Johnson.
Oh, wow.
And
we're going back here again, huh?
I would say that at that time, we said that there was not enough of a depth and a breadth to the work that he had done.
It wasn't about the depth and breadth of the work. It was just about other things that I think... like created political lapse or dubiousness.
Oh, wait, I forgot. He's like a half-assed Republican, right?
He's a half-assed Republican. He endorsed Bush at the 2000 president, at the RNC.
Which really is kind of a participation in that sort of like...
He didn't need to do that.
Well, it's like this political, cultural masculinity and like muscularity that again is like such a creature of the 80s that you know really isn't necessary, and you know so like,
and it was commercially calculated,
because
he was still The Rock at the time and he was still just like crossing over into like movies and stuff, and it was just sort of like it's his demo, it's his like WWE demo, you know.
Now, do we feel like Terry Crews has enough places to go to merit this? Where do we feel like his career could go?
I feel like do I think he's ever going to care, be like in a twofer? No. Like, I think he's going to always be a reliable third, fourth lead, fifth lead, but he's going to be memorable in the sense like, okay, Dick Miller died today, and Dick Miller was a character actor. He was in Gremlins. He was in like a number of old school horror and like schlocky, you know, sci-fi movies. And the one thing about him is like he was good at doing that really well. It was quality every single time. He was always giving his all, and that's the way I feel about Terry. And I feel that way in turn. And like he was in Bridesmaids. He plays the, you know, that trainer in the beginning of the movie, memorable line, kind of sets the tone and like puts it into another, you know, it really is a important scene. It just really shows these friends at the beginning of this movie and the evolution of their friendship. But like, he's always in the mix of that type of narrative.
I have to say,
on screen,
anybody who can go into a role in a big budget comedy where they have fewer than 15 lines and put some real spin on
it.
It's like,
be a presence.
Yes. You know?
Such added
Make
value.
Make that shit work.
May I submit to evidence?
Oh, yes. Boy.
Actually, speaking to Winter's
That's
point
right.
here, that, you know, Terry Crews had a GQ interview about his top 10 most iconic characters. But I was less interested, actually, in what he said about his iconic characters than the line he opens this video up with and his approach to selecting roles.
I would much rather have a tiny role in an awesome movie than to be the head guy in something that's just,
I mean, isn't that the truth?
And that's his ethos. And that's actually, we need people who feel that way about the world, who are quality control in the choices that they make.
Exactly.
So Terry Crews understands, you know, he's probably not going to carry a movie. I mean, maybe John Cena should understand that at some point.
Just think
about
the number of
movies
we've gotten just because somebody had enough buzz that they could get like a script and a project going, and they are just forgettable movies that kind of like, I mean, no offense, but like, those rom-coms with Marissa Tomei after she won her Academy Award, it's like, maybe if we hadn't done the baboon heart thing, like, you could have, there could have been more in the bedrooms and the wrestlers in your life.
Oh my God. I forgot all about that.
Yeah, but I mean, but the idea that like this person is out here, somebody who can demonstrate the good choices they make in their artistic career, I think has a lot to offer around making good choices in the world and life in general.
Look, he's a straight up, back in the day, I'm just going to say it, he was like a Mandingo. Like, he would have only had one purpose in a movie that was predominantly black and that was schlocky or blaxploitation. Like, that would have been where he was placed no matter what his talent level. The fact that he's evolved into a space making smart moves about the movies he actually participates in, being in White Girls is super schlocky and super dumb, but he's one of the most memorable parts of that movie.
Can we hear a little bit of it?
How did you know? I love this song.
Making my way downtown, walking fast, faces pass, and I'm homebound. And I need you, and I miss you,
And now I won. You know, one of the things that audio misses is just like the level of expressiveness
yes.
in his face, his eyes. It's never over the top. It's just perfectly on point.
Well, you guys both make a really great point, because for such a long time, like, black men in film, particularly comedy films mm-hmm. that were targeted towards white audiences, mm-hmm. were one of two things: either pure masculinity, mm-hmm. pure sexual aggression, or like pure emasculation, you know, sort of like the
nutty professor.
Or black guy having to be in a dress.
Yeah.
And Terry Crews brings so much humanity through all of his roles, and his physical presence yes. is sort of giving you like a degree of masculinity and sexuality that is present. You can't get away from it, but it's also human. I mean, this is like one of my problems with The Blind Side.
oh my god,
here we go.
It was just that, like, when I saw real Michael Orr, I was like, damn.
Yeah.
But then when I saw the dude who was in that movie, it was like, no, oh, we had to make a large black man safe for Sandra Bullock yeah. to have in her house.
Yeah.
And like, you know, it made me sad that we can't allow black men to have humanity and sexuality and physical prowess in the same place.
I mean, we give it to Mahershala. Mm-hmm. Mahershala? We give it to Mahershala Ali. I mean, I think that he's the new Quan to me in that, if we're looking at that
but
role.
Mahershala Ali is generally wearing a shirt, and he don't look like Terry Crews.
He doesn't, but there's like, again, that like that smoldering, like yes. sexy, like you know, like a move, like a movie idol from the 50s and 60s.
Yeah, and there's something nice about like letting a black man do what Channing Tatum gets to do, which
right.
is like be sexy and fuck around. All right, I'm not hearing a lot of negativity here. Let's go to the listeners. Maybe they have some really hard arguments against giving the Pop Rocket seal of approval, the turnover, to Terry Crews.
Hi, this is Damon from Minneapolis, and I'm calling from negative 70 degrees to tell you that Terry Crews definitely should get your seal of approval. Because he's positive, he knows how to make fun of himself, he has done everything from goofy commercials to crazy YouTube videos where he hooks up all of the instruments in the room to his different muscles and plays a whole song, to the other end of the spectrum of being a responsible citizen and coming forward and being brave and sitting before Congress and talking about sexual abuse and sexual harassment. And I think anybody who can do all of that and still show up to be a yogurt-obsessed sergeant on Brooklyn Nine-Nine deserves your seal of approval. Thanks. And stay warm.
Stay warm.
I mean, the thing is, the other thing that I think one of the reasons that maybe The Rock was an appealing first spontaneous nomination of yours, Guy, for the Pop Rocket Seal of Approval is this sense of, like, this is a person who works hard at what they do and who shows up for their job every day.
Yeah.
I think that one of the things that comes through in Damon's phone call is that, like, you know, Terry Crews carries that ethos with him. He definitely is like, this is somebody who shows up to work. They work hard every day, whatever their role they're in. They do it. They're there. They're present for it. I mean, I would argue, and like, this is going to be controversial, and I'm not saying I'll put him up for the Pop Rocket Seal of Approval, but I used to think this a lot about Mr. Bradley Cooper.
Oh.
You know, that he's somebody who is...
This team.
Who, you know, like, who has shown up for all the jobs that he's had. He's like really like, he's just there to play the game. He's just there to not even play the game, but just to be there as a member of the team and to like work hard. Even if it's, you know, as a side role on Wedding Crashers to, you know, to being on Jack and Bobby, the short-lived WB series. Anyway, not to steal from your shine, Terry, but, you know, I think that these are the kind of male figures in Hollywood that this lesbian separatist appreciates.
Well, I would say, similarly, somebody who has the option of being a cool guy
yeah.
and puts himself, like, in jeopardy and screws around, I would say that, you know, like him or hate him, Mr. George Clooney, like, you know, and I think particularly, like, George Clooney, all those years on shitty sitcoms means he, like, appreciates what he has and is willing to screw around and be the butt of the joke. And I think that, like, Terry Crews coming from, you know, I think a lot of former athletes who try to be entertainers or broadcasters, the comfort of being the cool guy is something that they, like, hold close. And Terry Crews being willing to be the very uncool guy is really impressive and, like, contributes so much to his place in this conversation about masculinity and harassment to be able to have an honest self. Should I call the question, you guys?
Yeah.
I think we should call the question. And then before we adjourn, I think that we should clarify what some of our procedures are for this Pop Rocket seal of approval.
All right.
Are we doing that again?
There's a list.
Oh, great.
All right. I call the question. All in favor of Terry Crews for the Pop Rocket seal of approval, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say nay. The motion carries. Congratulations, Terry Crews. You are the recipient of a turnover. You don't know what that is, and you will never listen to this. All right. Old business being completed. We now turn to the Pop Rocket Seal of Approval Committee parliamentarian, Karen Tongson, to let everybody know what the procedures are going to be for future turnovers.
There has been an intervention made by our producer, Laura Swisher, because... And I know many of you Rocketeers have been deeply frustrated by the ad hoc nature of this Pop Rocket seal of approval, which began as a whim, a bit of whimsy on the part of our host, Guy Branum, saying, let's, you know, nominate The Rock. Let's get back to it later. To then becoming this set of official procedures that became so arcane that we barely know what's going on.
There are now over 570 pages of bylaws. Things that seem to you ad hoc are actually very complex. We have intricate timings that are based on both the solar and lunar calendars. There's a lot going on.
And this is, you know, and one of the things, too, is just like all of you have presented many, many names to us, and you know, some of them succeed, some of them fail. We've gone through The Rock, we've gone through Rachel Bloom. Who knows if we'll ever recover from the bloom out. But so what our producer has suggested is that, like the Academy Awards, we're going to have a 2-week period in which listeners can call in with their nominations. It's not enough to just tap, tap, tap on your Facebooks or on your Twitters, but you've got to call Guy's mom at our Pop Rocket number with your nominations.
Can I make a suggestion?
Yes.
I think if we're doing it quarterly, we should do them after the big four
awards.
Pagan festivals of the year.
Oh, wow.
This was the in-bulk turnovers. then we'll have, you know, summer solstice and then Samhain and then Yule.
Okay, well, there you go. I mean, something like that. Basically, we'll tip you off on our socials to let you know. But there's going to be a 2-week period in which listeners can call in with their nominations and, you know, and we're going to open nominations up before the vote, 2 to 3 week period before the vote. And we're going to make sure everyone is aware on our socials. Each panelist can also nominate someone, but they need to do it within that same period, and we need to declare that on air and also address all the socials. Again, this is a formal process.
This doesn't really narrow down how...
Who gets nominated?
Right.
Well, I think that's for us to determine. I like the idea, since I just came up with that pagan festivals thing, that maybe... Oh,
this is how shit happens, right?
Yes.
Right.
Like, this is the turnovers when we harvest. So maybe we go for somebody in the autumn of their career. This is the turnovers when foals come and the milk begins to flow.
So somebody who's recently pregnant or had child. I'm loving this.
But I do think that it's like leaving it open to people from a range of different parts of their careers is important. I think that from precedent, our listeners know that if there's someone who's totally too green and has only done one major thing, that they might have a a diminished chance of being passed through the panel. But, you know, if you have a convincing frickin' voicemail, if you call Guy's mom and she cries to us from hearing your voicemail.
I'm already throwing a name out for the next one.
Yeah, what's it going to be?
Richard E. Grant.
Oh, oh, well, you're going to have to say it during the official 2 weeks, but I don't think I'm going to fight with you on that.
Also, we'll see if a Rocketeer takes that up and sends us a voicemail,
Let us know.
2 points. If there are any Rocketeers who are voting members of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, and you are voting for fucking Green Book in any category.
You need to look in the mirror.
Yes, you need to look in the mirror. I think, Karen, what you're saying is that democracy is work. Yes. And what you're saying is that we didn't know we needed an Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez until we had an Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Yep.
And it is your work, Rocketeers, to come forward and bring forward those names and bring forward those arguments like Damon did today.
And make the case, yeah.
Yeah, I think I'm the AOC of this voting board.
Make the case for the Green Plan. Not the Green Book.
Not the Green Book.
All right, you guys. Does anyone move to adjourn?
We shall adjourn this conversation about the Pop Rocket seal of approval until
and
there
everybody.
Are foals.
Once you guys hear this particular episode, you should really tweet at him because I feel like he'd be down.
Yes.
I think he'd be down, and maybe you should tell him that we'd love to hear an acceptance speech from Terry Crews. We'd love to have a wonderful conversation with him about his career here on Pop Rocket.
Yes.
All right. We now adjourn the Pop Rocket seal of approval committee until we consider the Pop Rocket seal or the turnover of the warm summer months.
Okay.
You are listening to Pop Rocket. We're going to be right back to talk about the state of the Adam McKay right after this.
Hello, this is Amy Mann.
And I'm Ted Leo.
And we have a podcast called The Art of Process. We're talking about how the creative process is in itself an art form, in our opinion. There are underlying forms and structures that serve as a scaffolding for any creative endeavor.
We've been lucky enough over the past year to talk to some of our friends and acquaintances from across the creative spectrum to find out how they actually work.
We weirdly don't know as many musicians as you would expect.
New episodes will be coming every other Monday,
starting January 28th.
So please listen and subscribe at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcast.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Brandon. With me in the studio are
Winter Mitchell-Rohrbach
and Karen Tongson.
And in this award season, when we've been seeing a lot of Adam McKay with both Vice and Succession, I wanted to step back and talk about the state of the Adam McKay, because this is a guy who started out as a writer during one of the golden ages of SNL, working really closely with Will Ferrell on some of the most iconic sketches that we can think of. He then went off and worked, continued to work closely with Will Ferrell, creating Funnier Die and, you know, writing.
Gary Sanchez Productions.
Yeah, writing and directing Anchorman 2, and then producing a bunch of, broad comedies throughout the 2000s. And then we've seen in the past, 4 or 5 years, a real pivot to directing and writing The Big Short, and directing and writing Vice. Being one of the EPs on Succession, which is a very, he's doing these sort of, arch dramedies. To me, there's just something so interesting about The Big Short, Vice, and Succession as films that are trying very hard to be relevant, and I don't know if they are. It feels like somebody who's finally decided to buckle down on his work.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if they're good. And so I just wanted to talk about where Adam McKay is right now.
I can't believe I'm disagreeing with you. Only because I feel like it shows the moral failings of basic white men who enter into extraordinary circumstances.
Okay.
So he doesn't play them as they're slick. They're, probably have some degree of humor about them that they like self-deprecating, but they're intense. And I never feel like the characters at the end of his movie are ever very satisfied, particularly Big Short, Vice, or Secession. So I never feel like anyone's completely satisfied because they haven't made enough of a mess of something. And I don't know why I would be at all interested in the complexities of, like, rich white men, which is sort of what these movies sort of highlight.
Yeah.
But for some reason, it's the humor and it's the slow way that he kind of goes about it. I feel like all the learnings he got from SNL and everything he put into Funny or Die and what that became, I really, really think that that has informed the quality of work that he's done. I think it was helpful to him to be a part of these, you know, comedy
ensembles and with other people and in teams and in collaboration.
Like in both Vice and The Big Short, he's writing so hard. Like in The Big Short, he has all of those like asides to explain stuff that you wouldn't really understand.
Right.
In Vice, there are these beautiful moments of dramatization that are highly stylized to sort of like embrace the moment. But it fundamentally comes down to white guy on white guy talk. And I don't know that it is that different from Anchorman in that it is still a room full of dudes. And even the, like, there's something about the white liberal straight guy shitting on those guys on the other side. It's a little bit the game of the Bernie bro. Continues to center dudeness and fighting and sort of almost lionizes the big dogs on either side while sort of like ignoring the other people exist. Because, I mean, even Vice, I mean, Amy Adams is good, and there is sort of like a gesture at a conversation about who Lynn Cheney was and her frustrations. But I feel like he can't entirely get behind it because he just loves what goofy big characters George W. Bush and Cheney are.
It's not like, right women.
Yeah, it's like a funny pissing pee-pee on the table kind of game. But, you know, one of the things that before we came in to record tonight, like we were watching together this video, who our guest producer tonight, Casey, was like reminded us I was like the food pawn shop sketch from the year 2000 in SNL. And thinking about that sketch, for those of you who don't remember that far back, because we certainly didn't, we had to rewatch it, you know, there's something really sort of incisive about the kind of class critique and just the absurdity that comes through in this sense of like a place of inequality where, you know, there's a pawn shop where you sell food, where you pawn food, you bring waffles in, you try to pawn spearmint gum. You know, there's like a confusion between the Sprite can you're drinking out of and the Sprite can that's there on display for customers to, like, you know, spend their hard-earned shekels on. And Steve Buscemi started it with Horatio Sanz and Will Ferrell. And there was something in that. And again, I think that this resonates with your Bernie bro comments, because there was something in that that was so deeply searing and class conscious, but also funny and just absurd. Like Adam McKay specialized in specializes in an absurdism in his comedy.
Yeah.
And the thing about Vice in particular that made me feel like this guy excels at Bush era, W era, like comedy, a W era ethos. It's like fighting W with W. It's like, let's make jokes, let's make nicknames. It's like part of like a whole bro culture.
I feel like he was, I don't mean it.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
I feel like he was doing that, especially post 9/11.
Yeah.
There was this need to sort of put these dudes in their places.
Yeah.
And if you look at Talladega Nights, it's a complete spoof. A complete spoof of a culture that is lionized, Midwest, love it. That's all they care about. And we're sort of mocking it.
Yeah.
But in a way that was still in the language that they understood. I think there's something, you've got to be incredibly smart to do that.
Yes. Well, I think so too.
Yeah.
But I think that he's still very much working with that understanding of the world. I think that's why Vice is such a telling project for him to be working on, as like a prestige project, prestige cinematic project, because like he deeply understands that world. He deeply, he knows how to dissect that set of social relations, that like, you know, fight of different kind of masculinities.
Well, I mean, the thing is like the spoofing our leaders and calling them ridiculous is essentially meaningless at a point that our leader is ridiculous, you know?
Right.
Like in so much of a way, mid-2000s comedy, The Daily Show, and all of this stuff combined, like, I mean, who is Donald Trump but Ron Burgundy?
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And And sort of making that lovable doofus lovable contributes to that. And I wonder what the relevance is. And like with Vice, like I feel like Vice is reflective of so much good quality work by a very smart person. And at the end, spoiler alert, like the resonant ending image that we have in Vice is Dick Cheney with no heart where his heart should be. Oh, what an insightful point to make in 2019. You really hit it on the head. And when I think about Yorgos Lanthimos and his fucking rabbits, or if mm-hmm. I think about like the plane soaring through the sky at the end of Roma, and I think about these people who managed to say something with complexity and ambiguity,
yeah.
that something that nail on the head, like it's a little bit like Vices, maybe it's a lot of craft, but is there art there? You know,
I think that one of the things about Adam McKay's oeuvre is that like it's funny, mm-hmm. and it's touched a demo that like of people who would otherwise be unmoved by the Romas of the world or uh-huh. the favorites of the world, right? That he knows how to speak to that demo, to that crowd, and like he can.
Do you think they saw The Big Short?
I don't know. That's the thing, though. I think they've seen and they rewatch Step Brothers, Talladega Nights. Yeah. You know, both Anchormans. Like that's what they return to, right? And in a way, it's because it has a moral to it, but it's not. It doesn't have the didacticism of like a you know, Vice or Get Shorty.
Okay, you know? Karen, let's get honest.
Yeah.
And I'm going to speak in Californian to you here. Okay. Part of what bothers me about Adam McKay is it is like the funny guy from the jocks deciding he's going to run for CSF president. CSF is the California Scholarship Federation.
Yes.
And it's I hate that this award show season is like, oh, look, I worked hard. From Peter Farrelly, who made
The Green Book,
which is an infinitely more execrable film than Vice.
Like right.
Vice is a work of art next to Green Book.
But there's something so funny about the fact that like Green Book is picking up some statuettes in a way that Vice isn't necessarily.
Yeah.
I mean, Christian Bale could be best actor, like, but the Green Book is like getting
I don't think it has, this is like exclusive and scandalous, but I don't think it's going to make it that far across the line.
I certainly hope not.
Something just tells me that people are literally like taking like an exit short of their destination on this one.
But I a little bit feel like these guys are like, they're both a little bit like, I'd like an Oscar now.
Yeah.
And it kind of annoys me from people who like, you know, what they're good at. There's something about Mary. It's a great movie, you know. Anchorman and Anchorman 2, truly magnificent films.
Yeah,
and I do feel like Adam McKay is giving us so much more work in the stuff he does, and like he really is trying to take intellectual questions and wrestle with them. I don't know if he has anything to say about now. He definitely has stuff to say about 2006, which I think is a really incisive point.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. And I think that even like Succession, you know, it's kind of like revels in that understanding of the world. I think that what it doesn't understand about the world, I think it intuits that like the absurdity that he parodied and that he made comedy out of is just going to achieve a certain status and stature that is impenetrable.
Yeah.
There's some hint of like an acknowledgement of that, but there is this kind of like revisionist historical sense that it's just sort of like, if we just revisit this moment in time, if we see how fucked up it was that Dick Cheney like basically engineered like the public opinion and kind of legal and social mores in a way to understand true executive power that we get at Trump. That's a very, very subtle point to come out of a movie like Vice, right? It's just sort of like, and this, of course, leads to rampant, unchecked presidential power that then, you know, is going to lead to people worshiping a fascistic type figure. I mean, it doesn't go far enough. You know what I mean? It should tilt over a little further.
I mean, the fact that it did talk about the imperial executive is a really good point that I don't think about enough. And also, I watched Vice with my mom, who voted for Bush both times, didn't vote for Trump, but is sort of that person who kept watching it and was convinced because the tools of this filmmaker she doesn't know who Adam McKay is, but she loves Adam McKay films, mm-hmm. you know? And, like, he has the right tools to get her to a point where she had to watch that movie and be like, I can't argue with anything in it.
Well, I was telling Karen earlier, he gives me, like, Paul Thomas Anderson vibes. Mm-hmm. There's just something about the way he makes movies and the pacing and the way it sort of has, like, this signature Adam McKay-ish to it, whether it's, you know, inflected in the writing or the directing or the entire, you know, casting scenario, like putting Christian Bale in two of these roles, which are wildly different, but like making, you know, it's not the choice that they got someone to do it and it happened to be Christian Bale. I just think to know that he would fit perfectly into this role to do that and then build this world around him. You know, I just felt like Vice, it was not the best movie, but it wasn't as far as like movies about politicians, especially in this era. Mm-hmm. I think it was one of the better ones. It was better than W.
I never thought about that until you were making that point that like Adam McKay wrote the least sketch comediest of films about the Bush White House.
Yes. And it just happened to be about the person that people don't usually focus on.
And I don't want to just be shitting on this guy because I really do respect. Like, there's this fascinating way that Funny or Die produced Billy on the Street, produced Throwing Shade, and like they created Gloria Sanchez, the whole purpose of which was like to give women voices in comedy, but so much of that hinged on the fact that when they were making Gary Sanchez stuff, they could never find a place for women to matter. And I think there's something really interesting for straight white guys in 2019. Like, he got to be king of the world in 2007 when we thought straight white guy comedy was the end all and be all. And that he is wrestling to figure out what his place is good. That what he's going for is, you know, rich people are fucked up. I mean, I don't know. That's
I have
a lot.
Two thoughts.
Yes.
One, if we're talking about people who rose to prominence doing a particular kind of straight guy, white guy comedy in this period, I much prefer the Adam McKay approach than the Judd Apatow approach.
Okay.
Oh. In part because I think that what Adam McKay does, even though he works with a certain set of people, it's not that like cloying little coterie of like, you know, in joke, let's like improv in this particular way. Like, some of that stuff is great. Some of it's funny. It's just like, I love when, you know, Seth Rogen can describe someone's face as looking like Robin Williams' knuckles, whatever. But like, you know, but it is, you know, he's reliant on the talent in many respects to create a particular kind of, you know, realist vision and comic vision of what life is like for people. Adam McKay, I think I admire his sense of grandiosity and grandeur and message and his desire to say something beyond like the everyday dudes being funny thing, and that the dudes being funny thing has larger consequences in Adam McKay's world, whether or not it's about the fate of like, you know, like a kind of historical vision of the media or like the fate of the future of the United States. I think that he has, like, he's thinking in on a larger scale, and I admire that. And I think that in the end, his legacy, and I know that's a lot to like predict for someone in the middle of his career, but I think in the end, his legacy is going to be, he's going to be considered a great absurdist historian of the decade 2000 to 2010. And he's going to be like one of the greatest like people to kind of capture like a kind of absurdist take on that moment that like, you know, reaches us in some emotional way, which is to laugh at it.
Well, I also think that there's the possibility that after a couple of stabs that were good but not great, he's going to hit great. You know,
right?
Like his
obviously
his next thing is Bad Blood, which is basically a sort of real life thing exploration of the Theranos lady, Elizabeth Holmes, starring Jennifer Lawrence.
That's gonna be insane. Oh, yeah.
I'm interested.
Part of me worries because like David O. Russell, who honestly was
crazy man.
I know, but at the beginning of his career, he had a lot of stuff that had interesting women in it.
Sure.
And then he stopped, and then he made fucking Joy, and I was like, finally, he's gonna do something like with a human story to it. And Joy was Joy was a cum dumpster.
Wow.
It was terrible.
I didn't. like, hate Joy.
Joy went nowhere. But
I didn't hate it either.
Like,
wow.
Did anything happen in that movie?
No.
Yes.
Wow.
Bradley Cooper was in it, and so was Jennifer Lawrence, and their magic together. Yes.
Right.
But I really have hope that Adam McKay is going to be able to work with Jennifer Lawrence and treat her as somebody who is capable of the kind of big comic audacity
absolutely
that Carell is and that Christian Bale is.
He absolutely will. I have like zero doubt about it. I feel like her last film was the Russian agent who was also a sex pot, right?
Something Bird, right?
Right. And then the before
something
that was
Bird.
Yeah, and then something but sorry, but the and then the project before that was Mother. And so take the sexy Russian agent out of the equation, because I feel like that does not count. And just go back to her last role, which is Mother. The only way she can pivot into a scenario where we're like not annoyed by her and just appreciate her being here is killing this movie. And yes. I think they together will be able to do that.
Also, I'd like to say if Adam McKay ever wants to do a Kabbalah allegory, I am down for it.
Well, I mean, also, though, I mean, one of the things that I appreciate about Adam McKay, as much as we're kind of talking about him here, like, in, you know, let's get meta with it, he's pretty self-aware of, like, his own praxis.
Yeah.
And I think that there is, again, like, in much the same way that we've been talking about, like, you know, whatever, Terry Crews or Bradley Cooper, people like that, like, doing the work, he does the work. And there is this clip. This is an exclusive. Like, he actually was here at Max Fun today talking to Jesse. And this...
No!
Yeah, and this is some of what he had to say about what he does in relation to comedy and drama.
They're both kind of the same thing. With the comedies, you're breaking routine, you're shocking, you're going into the world of absurdity, and you're kind of jarring an audience, you're screwing with their expectations. And that's exactly what needed to happen in The Big Short and Vice, because if you just list the details of the financial crisis, everyone glazes over. But if you can think of a way to give it a pop and a life and connect and break routine when the whole story of the financial crisis is really a break in routine, or as Adam Davidson called it, you know, they use weaponized boredom to kind of get away with this kind of stuff. So we have to kind of break that weaponized boredom.
I find it striking that he uses the word absurdist there, because I do think that that's the idiom that he's working in. You know, maybe he's like, maybe he's the new millennium's Samuel Beckett or whatever, but I think that there's something there. But all that said, like, I think that level of commentary too just kind of indicates it's like smart stuff that you'd find in good liberal media, right?
Yeah. So, like, the first point is just there is in absurdism a little bit of nihilism, a little bit of there's no point. And that feels like a safe thing for white guys to do, because they're always going to be fine. And then sort of like the second part of that is classically, a tragedy ends in somebody dying. And a comedy ends with a heterosexual couple getting together and having the specter of new life. And both The Big Short and Vice are things that end with people dying, you know, and are sort of about, like, it is interesting to make absurdist comedies about these tragedies that we are in the middle of. And does that make them subjects that we can more actively think about because you're not getting subsumed by pathos? Like, what is the advantage of making comedies about these things?
I don't know. I mean, I think the advantage of making comedy about these things is that...
Because I think there is an advantage. I just want you to articulate it for
me. I mean, I think the advantage of making comedies about these things is essentially, it's a very dark, dark idea, but it's just like you have to laugh at the inevitable extinction of a way of life, the way we've understood the world to be. And that doesn't end in anything radiant or uplifting or even transformative. It's just, you know, it's just we all die. And like these things, these happenstances, the world that we live in accelerates that. And it's dark, but you have to be able to laugh at it, or else what else are you going to do? You know?
It's a very Jewish answer. All right. You are listening to Pop Rocket. We're going to be right back. Mitch Jams after this.
Yeah. Is there a dog in a car at a bar on the street?
Yay! I'm Allegra Ringo, a small dog owner. My dog Pistachio howls when she's excited.
And I'm Renee Culvert, a big dog owner. My dog Tugboat tips over when he's sleepy.
And we co-host a podcast called Can I Pet Your Dog that airs every Tuesday. We bring you all things dog.
Yes, dog news, dog tech, dogs we met this week. We also have pretty famous guests on, but Legs, we're not going to let them talk about their projects.
No.
Just want to hear about those dogs.
We don't want to hear about your stuff, only your dogs. So join us every Tuesday on Max Fun.
Welcome back to Pop Rocka. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are
Winter Mitchell Rohrbaugh
and Karen Tongson.
Every week on Pop Rocka, we ask our panel, what's your current jam? Winter Mitchell, hath thou a jam?
My jam is Girls Need Love by Summer Walker. This is an artist who's not new to the scene. She's been around for a while. And when I say a while, I mean like 24 months, because that's how time is now for me. But maybe 36. She sounds like SZA, has a vibe like her. But I feel like that's insulting saying both of those things, because she's unique in her own way. She's unique. She's who she is. She's Summer Walker. I was listening to Beats One like a week ago, and she was doing her where she sits down with the DJ and sort of goes over her songs. So doing a discography, like discussing, you know, her catalog, and live in London. And I just thought, this chick has totally gets it. Quadrants on Fuego. I can't be more and yeah, and Wago quadrants on all levels. And so this is her song, Girls Need Love.
Girls can never say they want it. Girls can't never say yeah. Girls can't never say they need it. Girls can't never say nah. Girls can't never say they want it. Girls can't never say yeah. Girls can't never say they need it.
That's stoned putting makeup on, though.
Yeah, really? You think so? That's like a straight baby maker. That's all I think about in that song.
I mean, I don't like living in times where fucking music is the dominant sort of like straight.
Oh, you mean fucking music?
Fucking music.
Yeah, I know it's not. It's we need fucking music right now. Have you seen everybody?
I mean, that's true.
I'm sorry. I would normally be like, you're right, Guy, but I'm just going to stand right now in the, on the light of day, January 30th, 2019. This year has not started off that brilliant.
It's not where we wanted to be, for
and
sure.
Valentine's Day is right around the corner, and y'all, we need to be fucking.
Fair. Fair.
Absolutely.
Karen, do you have a jam?
I do have a jam. And speaking of, like, you know, 2019 isn't working out the way we want it to, we've had such a rough week of news. And on the day that we had to grapple with the assault and attack on Jussie Smollett, we also grappled with the loss of a very important figure, a beautiful R&B singer who was not only important to fans of R&B and people of the R&B community, that whole thing, but who is so deeply ingrained in the Filipino and Filipino-American conscience and consciousness. And that is James Ingram. And he passed away this week. And there's not a single Filipino I know who was born, you know, after 1980 or even like between the years 1973 to now, who doesn't know this beautiful song where he sings lead. It's technically a Quincy Jones song, but come on. It's James Ingram. And this is Just Once.
Just once. Can we find a way to finally make it?
It's in the canon of all karaoke songs for Filipinos, but also just, you know, James Ingram, like, he's somebody who's like a songwriter, a supporting player in so many projects. Again, like so many of his first hits, like this Quincy Jones album, The Dude.
Yamo,
like,
Be There.
Yamo, Be There with Michael McDonald.
Yamo, Be There.
Baby, Come to Me with Patty Austin. And
Somewhere Out There.
Somewhere Out There with Linda Ronstadt. And, you know, I Don't Have the Heart. He was only 66 years old. We will miss you forever, James Ingram. But that throaty, soulful voice is there with us forever.
Karen, are you going to publish a definitive karaoke canon? canon.
Yeah. I want like volumes though.
I couldn't possibly. I could do it for like one demo and whatever, but you know, maybe it'll be like Now That's Called Music, but Now That's Called Karaoke, the Karen Thompson archive, and we could do it like year by year.
That would be amazing. Look, I like pop culture resolution to not have cop-out jams. And I don't know if this counts as a cop-out jam. But 2 weeks ago on Drag Race, a truly epic thing happened. Rue, it's an all-star season. Rue brought back all of the eliminated queens to pick one of the queens currently in the competition and go head-to-head with her. Ooh. And we were all waiting for Monique and Latrice to face off to settle scores from the week before. What we did not realize is that Gia Gunn going up against Naomi Smalls would be one of the most great epic battles of all time, where Naomi Smalls, who no one had been expecting much from, who had been running at the middle of the pack, pulled out so many fucking gags and goops and rakakakas that she could not be denied. And I've been listening to the song. And of course, like near the end of the season, Rue starts having them lip sync to Rue's song so people will buy Rue's songs. And I fucking bought Rue's song. So let's hear Adrenaline by Rue.
One shot, one shot.
Great.
What?
I love this.
Oh no, it's so wonderful and so early 90s retro, but yes. Perfect.
It's the sound of the future from the past.
Yes.
I mean, eventually there are these can I get it to go, can I get it to goes that happen. All right, let me tell you the most important thing that happened. Gia Gunn, like truly the shit stirrer of this season, first person to be on Drag Race while openly trans, had a clear reveal planned. So she goes to the back, pulls off schoolgirl uniform that she has on, pulls it off entirely like gold fringe underneath, and starts coming at us with like an old school voguing pass. And it's like, well, look what this bitch doing. Naomi Smalls, who's fucking 25 years old, gives up the stage, goes to the back and prepares her shit. And like the minute you're done watching Gia Gunn, you see that Naomi Smalls, 6'5", is fucking sliding herself with her 4-foot-long legs down the runway, to use Monique Exchange's terms, or no, it was Monique, the goop. All right. All right, guys. You've been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Guy Branum, with Margaret Wappler, Winner Mitchell Rohrbaugh. Oh, Margaret wasn't here. The script says Margaret was here, but Margaret was off doing other things. We're not giving her credit. And Karen Tonkin, who's fucking present, you guys. Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Mizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to everyone for the 5-star reviews on iTunes. If you haven't already, please review us. This week, we'd like to thank MP Weinman. They said, one of my favorite podcasts never fails to give me a new perspective and take me deeper into pop culture. CC Crow said, this show is consistently funny, with a great balance of fun and punchy assessments of pop culture, along with more serious intellectual reflections about important topics. I'm a longtime listener of PCHH, and I started listening after hearing Guy's interview with Linda Holmes. The hosts have a great chemistry, with Karen Thompson bringing some intellectual weight to the conversation, Winner bringing incredible energy, Margaret bringing a reflective hipster spirit, and Guy being the glue that holds it all together. You guys, I've always prided myself on my connective tissue. The hosts don't always agree and yet respect and genuinely seem to like each other. Well, I guess the facade is working, you guys, because
Checks in the mail, guy.
Do not talk off of these microphones. And that one makes it such a joy to listen to. If you want us to hear your feedback or even ask a panelist for advice or tell me that my jam was indeed a cop-out, you can call us at 530-237-4108. It's a Sacramento area code, so you know it's my mom listening. Next week on Pop Rock, each of us is committed to seeing a film that we missed when it was first in theaters so we can play catch-up. Should we all say what our films are?
Mine is going to be Roma.
Oh, and mine is going to be Colette.
And Margaret's is going to be Can You Ever Forgive Me, because I assigned that to her. And mine is the Blake Lively and...
A Simple...
favor.
A simple favor.
A simple favor.
I did watch it. It's really good. Get in touch with us on Twitter. We're at Pop Rocket, or join our Facebook group and get in the discussion. We're a production of MaximumFun.org. The show is edited by Shayna Deloria, who's super fun. And our senior producer is Laura Swisher, who is a good time on occasion. But we have a real different producer this time. I forget your name.
Casey O'Brien.
Wow. Actually produces tonight.
Wow, Casey.
I was very responsible. Good night.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.